Lawyer characterized the documents as, quote, a small number of documents bearing classified markings that were inadvertently transported to the personal home of the former vice president at the end of the last administration, close quote. He added that Pence requested a review of materials at his house following news of classified documents being uncovered at President Biden's residence and former office. The lawyer said the documents were found on January 16th and placed in a secure safe until they could be returned to proper authorities. The FBI and Justice Department's National Security Division are now reviewing the documents and investigating how they wound up in Pence's home. From WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Raising money today for the Tower Fund here at WBAI.
And without that tower, we can't stay on the air.
Please, just give what you can.
And those contributions can be small or they can be large, but those are the contributions that we need to make in order to beat back the other side. No one is going to do it for us.
Even a few dollars a month helps to keep us on the air.
Let's face it, without Pacifica, what do you have? NPR is too milquetoast. PBS, too milquetoast. Without Pacifica, we're dead in the water.
And that pledge line is 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950.
And we're only asking those who can give it, those who can afford it. We know that there's some people out there who cannot afford it, and that's one of the problems. Those of us who relatively have must stand up for those who have not.
I'm sick and tired hearing people complain about, well, you know, the right wing has Fox News and they have this and they have that. The oppressor always has more money than the oppressed. We have to make use of the resources that we have. We have people and we have people that can make contributions.
Here on WBAI 99.5 FM, we want to have the Tower Fund strong and healthy so we're not worried about it.
212-209-2950.
Or you can go online at WBAI.org and donate to the Tower Fund.
Activist Sharon Salam speaks out for WBAI.
We should be moving forward, collecting the funds that we need to make sure that our station is whole and that it can do its job as it has done for me in the past. When all of this stuff happened to me many, many years ago in 1989, I didn't get very many opportunities to speak out in regards to the wrong that was done to my son and the other boys in the Central Park jogger case, as it was called at that time. Very few people stepped up. Yes, Like It Is was there, WBAI was there, and a few others. Majority of those stations that let people like myself speak and tell them what was going on the other side, those stations are gone. If we lose WBAI, where do we go to get our words out? Where do we go if you've been arrested unjustly? Where do you go if someone's taken your children unfairly? Where do you go to seek justice? We must keep this station alive. Yeah. Alive. WBAI.
No justice. This is listener-sponsored, locally controlled WBAI New York.
Hey, everybody. I'm Harriet Cole, host of Dream Leapers here on WBAI. Guess what? We have a new time, a new date and time, Wednesdays at 2:30 p.m. for an action-packed half hour. I'm going to bring you some of the most inspiring people that I know and have met to inspire you to leap into your dreams. So don't miss us, Wednesdays at 2:30 p.m., starting in December.
All right, and this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. It is 4 minutes past 1 p.m. Stay tuned for Leonard Lopate at Large coming up. okay, it's going to be one of those days, I see. sometimes you got to laugh before you get to prevent you from crying. So I'm laughing. Anyway, let's try this again. Stay tuned for Leonard Lopate at Large here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. It is 7 minutes past 1 p.m. Stay tuned.
Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. I'm so sorry we're having these technical problems or some issues in the building I'm doing the show from. How much does the food we eat affect our mental health? In her new book, Eat and Flourish, How Food Supports Emotional Well-Being, Washington Post food journalist Mary Beth Albright draws on the latest scientific research to explain the connections between food and mood. It's published by Countryman Press, an imprint of W.W. Norton, and brings Mary Beth Albright to our show now. Welcome.
Hey, Leonard. How are you today?
Okay, but a little upset by the technical problems. There are internet problems in my building, and that has caused us to lose a fair amount of time in a discussion that I was really looking forward to. Let's see.
Well, we still have some time, so let's get at it.
Okay. Well, you begin your book by pointing out that food is pleasurable and that our brain activity can be mapped and studied. Is it different when we eat alone or with other people?
Well, and I'm so glad you asked. Go ahead. Well, I'll go ahead and answer the question because the first thing you bring up is food pleasure. And I love that that's the first thing you brought up because it's the entire first chapter of the book. It's all about food pleasure because we forget that food pleasure is a form of nourishment, is a type of nourishment that food gives us. It's not just about nutrients. It's not just about fiber, although those things are important. I wanted to make sure that when I came to the science about how food and mood are inextricably entwined, I wanted to come at it with the mind of a food writer because, and a person who loves food, because I think that that's how all of us at first come to food. And then we're also concerned about the nutrients and that kind of thing. So yeah, there's a lot going on in our brains with food pleasure. Is there something specific that you wanted to know about?
Well, you write about the time you drank wine and kale juice inside an fMRI machine. What do you learn from that?
Yeah, you know, it's not the usual reason that people go into fMRIs, right? And it's funny because if you know anything about functional MRIs, it shows the activity that's happening in your brain while you're doing something. Now, people are thinking about MRIs. Generally, they're like those big tubes and you have to lie down and it's really noisy and that kind of thing. But there are labs, there are food labs in this country that have the setup so that the liquid will drip into your mouth while it's looking at what's happening in your brain. And what this researcher who was doing this is Dr. Eric Stice out of Stanford University. And he usually does research with milkshakes. And I showed up at his doorstep with some wine and some kale juice as well. And so he let me into his fMRI and we looked at like the different pleasure centers that light up when you drink different things or eat different things. And as expected, I think we know this anecdotally, but science confirmed that the more we eat a certain food, the less pleasure we get from it, the more we need to be fulfilled and filled. And so there's a lot of research going on around that.
You define emotional eating based on the science. What's emotional eating?
Well, it's interesting because when I started doing this research, it was 15 years ago. I was at the Surgeon General's office and
working for C. Everett Koop.
Well, I worked for C. Everett Koop prior to that. Now, after after Dr. Koop retired, I worked for him for years. And then I went to work at the current Surgeon General's office in public health. And there was a journal article that crossed my desk that showed that if you eat omega-3 fatty acids, that it reduced the incidence of aggression in men. And that was 15 years ago. And the research has really just exploded from there, because that was the first time 15 years ago that I'd seen an article in a peer-reviewed journal that was about how food and mood affect each other. And in the past 15 years, the research has really exploded and shown that having an eating pattern that we often think of as a healthy eating pattern, right? Fruits, vegetables, whole grains, fatty fish, healthy oils, actually also can reduce the incidence of depressive symptoms and anxiety symptoms. And it's really groundbreaking research.
So that's emotional eating, right? You interpret complex studies from the new field of nutritional psychology. What's nutritional psychology?
Yeah, and to get back to the emotional eating question, I'm sorry I didn't answer that question. What the science shows is that food and emotions are entwined, and we can either get to know this connection and get to know how to use it and use our biology in our favor, or we can negatively label things emotional eating and say, oh, I don't want to do that anymore, and deny that we do it. But the truth is that all eating is emotional eating, because our emotions are processed by our nervous system. They tell us, our emotions tell us how we feel about things that are going on outside of us, outside of our bodies. And the food, when we eat anything, there are biological reactions that happen in our body. It could be a carrot stick, it could be a piece of cake, but there are biological reactions that affect our emotions. And that food we eat actually creates the neurotransmitters and the hormones that create our emotions. And so all eating is emotional eating. And that's why I really wanted to redefine that term, so that we can take that back for those of us who really love food and who might feel like we have intense emotions. We can take that back. We can reclaim that phrase and use it to our advantage by getting to know our biology.
Does it matter whether we're eating with another person or a couple of people or a lot of people?
Well, shockingly, yes. It's so interesting. It's something in the book
that even though the nutrients are the same in all the cases?
Yes, the nutrients are always the same. There's nothing hoo-hoo going on, right? But in Eat and Flourish, in my new book, I get into what I call the feast paradox. And in America, I'll tell you what that is. In America, we often associate eating less with having better health, right? We're all trying to eat less. We're all trying to, you know, eat less food. But the feast paradox is that people who eat consistently with other people eat more, but they enjoy better health outcomes. And we don't know what the mechanism is for that, but there's research globally that shows this in America, in England, in Australia, in England, actually, in the United Kingdom. They have a program called the Big Lunch, which is based in science that encourages people to eat with their next door neighbors, because we find that people who have those strong relationships have better health outcomes and live longer. And so one big way to commune with other people is over food. And anytime we eat anything, there's dopamine released in our bodies, which can encourage us to bond with other people. So that's right. The nutrients are the same. There's no magic here. And it's all just about, you know, the power of the food system that we have right now. The system is really perfect. We're just not using it. We're going to things that are not so, you know, not as nourishing as the whole foods are.
What about just our biology? Don't our bodies, don't some people's bodies deal with nutrients differently than others?
100% yes. And every body is different. And, you know, obviously talk to your doctor about this. What I did in this book is combined research from all different disciplines, from neuroscience and from biology and from nutrition science, to figure out what that whether this food mood connection exists. And it's resoundingly yes. But we need to we need to use it. We need to eat actual food, real food, and not just the ultra high processed foods that can really damage a body through inflammation. But your question about about how differently people react to different foods, whether it be the nutrients or whether food allergies or anything like that. I need to mention here what's something that is called the gut microbiome. And the gut microbiome is the collection of trillions of microorganisms. And that's bacteria, that's viruses, that's fungi that live in your digestive tract, between your mouth all the way down to the other end. And there are trillions of them living in there. And they're each one of those trillions is its own unique being. It's its own unique microorganism. Those microorganisms, and everybody's gut microbiome is like a fingerprint. Everyone's is a little bit different. But the gut microbiome really influences a lot of how we behave, our social behavior, our sleep patterns. Are all affected by the gut microbiome, in addition to how we metabolize foods or how we metabolize medications. There's some evidence that the effectiveness of medications could be dependent upon what microbes you have in your own particular gut microbiome.
I'm speaking with Mary Beth Albright about her book, Eat and Flourish, How Food Supports Emotional Well-Being. It is published by a division of by Country Man Press, a division of W.W. Norton. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming live at WBAI.org. You say that research has linked changes in the gut microbiome and the enteric nervous system with depression, as well as associating omega-3 fatty acids with levels of aggression and inflammation with emotional stability. Can you please explain that?
Yeah, that's a mouthful, right? There are two separate things here. We're going to talk about the gut microbiome separate from inflammation. As I mentioned, the gut microbiome influences a lot of who we are. These little microbes, you can think of them like workers, right? These are little workers that exist all the way in your digestive tract. And the food we eat are the raw materials that the workers use in the factory to create substances. So those substances could be neurotransmitters like serotonin. They could be hormones like dopamine. And so we have these microorganisms that seriously affect how we feel and how we show up in the world. And I'll give you an example of that is that we all hear a lot around Thanksgiving about tryptophan, right? That tryptophan is the compound in turkey that makes people sleepy. And there have been a lot of studies showing that that tryptophan can actually be converted, can help convert serotonin. And so serotonin being what people call the quote unquote feel good neurotransmitter, right? So that's great that tryptophan can help with serotonin. But the thing is that if you have certain gut microbes, it could actually turn tryptophan into a different compound that can cause inflammation. So you really need to pay attention to the health of your gut microbiome. And if you're wondering, well, how do I do that? There are two ways. One is through the food you eat. They're both through the food you eat, but one is through getting fermented foods like yogurt, like sauerkraut, like kimchi, like kefir, which is basically drinkable yogurt. All of those foods have living microorganisms in there. And if they're refrigerated and they're fermented, you'll see that there are living microorganisms. When you eat those microorganisms, they don't take up residence in your gut microbiome, but they help the workers along the way. It's like bringing in really, really skilled workers for a few hours into a really well-performing factory. And then you're just going to get some better stuff out of that. And then the other, oh, sorry, go ahead. Yes, please.
No. Well, along those lines, don't certain foods help reduce the inflammation that can harm mental health?
Yes, that's correct. So, and I talk about...
Is that part of what we're discussing here?
No. So I talk about, it's all related. Like, this is the thing, is that it's funny because we tend to talk about the body as a separate sort of like a container for parts, and the body is a system. So the gut microbiome influences the inflammation. The inflammation influences the gut microbiome. So it's both impossible to separate them from each other because it's a system. And it's also impossible to talk about it without talking about them separately because it's so much information. So for the gut microbiome, I'll just finish that, which is the other thing that you can do is feed your gut microbiome by eating fiber. The microbes eat, as I said, they're each a living organism with their own genes and carrying their own stuff. And they're just all of them, again, 3 trillion of them living inside of you. And so when you eat fiber, you are feeding those microbes. If you don't get enough fiber in your diet, the microbes can start eating, because they have to eat something. They're hungry. So they start eating the lining of your stomach. And sometimes your stomach, sometimes your colon, but they eat like this sort of mucousy lining, which can lead to leaky gut problems because then your lining isn't as strong. And then, the toxins that are in your stomach can leak out into your blood. That can cause inflammation. And I'm happy to talk more about how inflammation then can cause emotional well-being problems.
Well, you provide a 4-week plan for building a diverse microbiome, reducing inflammation, and boosting nutrient intake and pleasure, which includes eating fermented food, legumes, and lots of produce, as well as, and is this really important, eating with another person at least once per day?
Yes, absolutely. Because we have those studies that show that if you're eating anything, your body is producing dopamine. That dopamine will help with bonding. And if you're sitting with another person, you're going to have, it's likelier that you are going to have a stronger bond if you have those hormones in your body that allow you to bond somebody with somebody. And eating does that. And if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense, because that's when we were, you know, millennia ago, even before agriculture, I mean, we really survived by eating in groups and eating around campfires, and working together. And so we've gotten away from that. And we live currently in a world of, you know, meals for one, meals in 30 seconds in the microwave, that kind of thing. And it's a result of the way that we live today. But it's a mismatch with our evolution and with our evolutionary background. We have a lot of evolutionary devices in our bodies that keep us from starving, that make sure that we get enough food. And there are no mechanisms in the body to make sure that we stop eating. We stay away from food. You don't have mechanisms like that. And so you really need to pay attention to the evolutionary mismatch between now and, you know, millennia ago.
You say it was critical to you that people could implement what you're talking about in real life without it sounding like a diet. When we say it's a diet, then that turns people off?
I think so. Just from anecdotally, again, from my experience in the world, I do think that diets turn people off. And it is, it's very, all of the science shows us that it's very difficult to stay on a rigid diet plan. It's not impossible, but for most people, as we can see, a lot of people who have tried to lose weight or whatever, most people have found it difficult, if not impossible, to stay perfect on a diet. I also was concerned about, you know, there's a lot of weight stigma in this world, and there's a lot of information that we have now about just how damaging weight stigma can be for people, for their emotional well-being. So regardless of, you know, what you think about the biological bases of obesity or having extra weight or whatever, having that feeling that you're not enough, or having that feeling that today you're not good enough, but tomorrow you will be, that's not good for your emotional well-being. So that's one of the reasons I really tried to stay away from the weight discussion, because it's not helpful at all. It's not that weight doesn't have anything to do with it, because weight can affect inflammation, and then that inflammation can affect your emotional well-being. But it doesn't make sense to focus on it, because that's not the evidence that we have.
A listener writes in to ask about the impact of sugar and antibiotics.
Yeah, so I'll take those one at a time. Sugar is can really cause a lot of inflammation in the body. And it's not, you know, I talked about how the Mediterranean diet has a lot of evidence behind it. The Mediterranean diet doesn't include no sugar. I mean, it includes like occasional desserts, or even a dessert a day. but if you have a bunch of refined sugar as part of your overall eating pattern, if you're eating a fair amount of refined sugar every day, that can cause inflammation in your body. And let me explain a little bit more about inflammation, because, inflammation is just your immune system at work. Think about it this way. You cut your finger and the finger gets swollen and red and it gets a little warm. That's your immune system at work. Because your body is sensing that something's wrong and it's going to help it. Now, our bodies tend to react to ultra high processed foods, including those with a lot of refined sugar, as a threat to our system. So when we eat those foods as a part of our dietary pattern, our bodies tend to become inflamed. Now, the thing about inflammation and emotional well-being is that it was thought until about 20 years ago that all of the toxins that are floating around in our blood could not reach the brain. And the brain was completely protected by something called the blood-brain barrier. What we now know, this is pretty recent, is that the barrier is not impenetrable. It's semi-permeable. So those really tiny inflammatory compounds that float around in our blood, when there's inflammation anywhere in our body for any reason, can get through to your brain and wreak havoc with your emotional well-being. So if you stay away from sugar, it is less likely that you're going to have that kind of inflammatory response. And remind me what the other food was.
Were you going to stay away from sugar completely or just cut down on it?
Oh, yeah. No, all of the science shows it points toward an overall eating pattern, dietary eating pattern. So when your body as a system has a regular influx of fruits and vegetables and whole grains and all those kinds of things that I was talking about, the system can handle some sugar. Mm-hmm. You know, for most people, I mean, talk to your doctor, and I'm talking here about people who don't have specific food allergies, of course, but that the inflammation that sugar, that refined sugar, and I'm talking about, you know, white cane sugar or sugars, corn syrup, sugars that are in ultra high processed foods that we don't use a lot of in regular life, but they're all over the place and packaged foods.
So matter whether it's processed sugar or maple syrup?
So those are two different things. So by processed sugar, I assume you mean white sugar. And by maple syrup, you know, natural, real maple syrup, not the kind of stuff that you get. There are a lot of stuff that you get at the grocery store. If you look at the label, it's not maple syrup. It's flavored corn syrup. And that is the vast majority of what you buy at the grocery store. So if you read the label and it says real maple syrup, then you're getting that sugar. You're still getting sugar, but you're getting it with a bunch of other nutrients that are inherent in maple syrup. And people tend to, there's a lot of brain research that shows that people tend to be able to control themselves less with refined sugar, white sugar, or corn syrup, or that kind of thing, than with something like maple syrup. That when you refine sugar, there's a breakdown in the system between the stomach and the brain. There's messages being sent between the gut and the brain constantly. And the gut will tell the brain when it's had enough sugar. But if you're having refined sugar, those messages appear to be blocked more than if you have something like maple syrup.
The other thing the listener wondered about was antibiotics and their impact.
Yes, and that is huge. So having antibiotics is like a forest fire in your gut microbiome. If you take oral antibiotics, the antibiotics, the point of them is to kill every microbe in its way. And you can't kill the bad microbes and just save the good ones. You can't do that. It's like a forest fire. And so I'm not anti-antibiotics. I mean, yay, antibiotics are, life-saving and crucial in some situations, but they are overused in today's food supply system. And so if you are on an oral antibiotic, you need to pay attention to repopulating your gut microbiome with those foods I was talking about, like yogurt, like fermented foods, and eating fiber. And the other thing is to really watch out for antibiotics in other places in the food system, particularly in meat. When you have meat that is raised in very small, tight conditions, which, most farms, most commercial farms are like that. You need to use antibiotics to keep the animals healthy. But then those antibiotics can get into the meat, and then you're getting antibiotics by eating large scale raised meat without even meaning to, and sometimes without even knowing it.
You're listening to London Lopit at Large on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. And streaming live at WBAI.org.
I'm going to be round my vegetables. I'm going to chop down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable.
I hope you're enjoying my conversation with Mary Beth Albright. If you sign up to become a member of WBAI during today's show with a contribution of $50 or more, you can receive a free copy of her book, Eat and Flourish, How Food Supports Emotional Well-Being. To do that, just call 212-209-2950 or go online to give to WBAI.org during today's show, and we'll be happy to send you a copy. That's 212-209-2950 or give and then the number 2, WBAI.org. But don't forget to make that $50 donation in the name of London Lopit at Large, and we thank you very much. And return now to Mary Beth Albright. Her book, Eat and Flourish, How Food Supports Emotional Well-Being, is published by Countryman Press. She's a writer, editor, executive producer at The Washington Post. She was a project director and subject matter expert for the U.S. Surgeon General and appeared on Food Network as well. Now, let's talk about some of the research that you describe here. What's the nature of Felice Jacka's work? Didn't she see evidence that people's diets were related to their experience of and risk for depression and anxiety?
Yes. Well, that study, Felice Jacka is in Australia, and she actually did the first randomized controlled study, dietary study, that showed that the Mediterranean diet by itself could reduce depression and anxiety symptoms more than talk therapy alone. And, when I wrote this book, one of my biggest concerns was that people would say, oh, okay, well, now I just need to eat this way and I'll be fine. And the message here is never to stop going to see your therapist. The message is not stop taking your medication, but it is that food is a tool in the toolbox that can really help. And that's what Felice Jacka's research showed. And then that was in Australia, and then all the way on the other side of the world.
Wait a minute, I want to continue with her just a
moment. Oh, yeah, no,
longer.
Please go ahead. Yeah.
She wrote, as you point out, that Western style diets that are high in sugar and unhealthful fats, low in nutrients, high in ultra processed foods lead to depression and anxiety as well, but most notably in women, more than in men.
It's not that it's more than in men. It's because we don't have that. We don't have the large scale studies that we would need to be able to say that women are more sensitive to these changes in their food supply than men are. What we can say is that we know that what you eat matters. So, you know, the dietary studies are so difficult to do because short of putting a webcam on someone's forehead and recording everything they eat all day, every day, it's very difficult to get the kind of control that you need for science. And that's why it's hard to get people to do long-term dietary studies, because as maybe you've experienced, I've certainly experienced, when you are told that you can only eat a certain way and you can't have this food or that food, that doesn't always last very long. And so the study, dietary studies that have the kind of review of what people are eating and when can get very expensive. For example, there was an NIH study that had people, two groups of people, live at NIH for an entire month so that they could make sure of what those people were eating. There's not a lot of people who have the funding to do that. So we don't know a lot about the differences between men and women, except for when we do very targeted studies on that. Otherwise, you need to just, you know, take the people who are willing to go to do your study.
How do our brains adapt to the pleasure we feel after we eat ultra-processed foods? Do you mean that our brains require increasing amounts of stimulation to achieve the same level of pleasure?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it almost acts like a tolerance. I mentioned earlier Dr. Eric Stice and his research at Stanford. And that's what it shows, is that we really, once we get used to eating a food, I'll back up a second. Let's say there's ice cream. You love ice cream, right? And it's not surprising, because ice cream has a sort of fat, sugar, sometimes salt balance that can really make our pleasure systems go crazy, right? Because it's the same pleasure.
Isn't the milk in it good for us?
Oh yeah, sure. I'm just saying that when you combine fat and sugar and salt, it can really it can really cause our pleasure circuitry to not overload, but get flooded with pleasure. Now, there are other times, it's the same pleasure circuitry that is used for everything. Same pleasure circuitry with sex, same pleasure circuitry with in the brain, it's the same pleasure circuitry with good music, listening to good music. When you see the same circuitry lighting up in the brain, so we know that it's all going through the same way, but when you enjoy something that is one of these foods over and over and over again, you build what is essentially a tolerance to it. So every time you eat it, your brain gets a little less pleasure and a little less pleasure, which is why, you know, one of the biggest tips in the book is about diversity. Diversity of your diet, no matter what you're eating, because then you're not only learning to enjoy new foods, but it's also that your brain isn't getting used to any one specific thing. There's a idea that is called Hebb's postulate, that is the neurons that wire together fire together, and that's just a fancy way to say neuroplasticity, which is that our brains are constantly learning, the neurons in our brains are constantly learning how to communicate with ourselves, with each other. And you mentioned earlier the enteric nervous system. When we hear about the nervous system, a lot of times we just think about the brain and the spinal cord. But there is something called the enteric nervous system that is in constant communication with the brain and spinal cord, but the enteric nervous system is the nervous system of the gut. The gut has its own nervous system that sends signals to the brain about what's in it, how it feels about it, that kind of thing. So this gut-brain axis, this loop that's constantly going on, is highly influenced by food. And now, I think we've all known that for a long time just from our own lives, but now we can see it through the science.
You cite the work of a number of other scientists. What did neurobiologist John Ryan's studies reveal?
Remind me what John Ryan, what he was doing.
Oh, well, actually, I didn't write it down in my notes.
Yeah, no, that's okay. Because there were a lot of people. I don't remember precisely what those studies were. I mean, as you know, there are more than 1,000 studies cited.
The question I was going to ask is, does everyone in the science community agree on what the latest research is coming up with?
No. Does everyone in the science community agree on anything, really?
On anything.
Yeah. And that's the nature of science. That's what's so great about it, is that science is a process. It's a process of having an hypothesis, of testing it, and then having more information. It's not that science changes, it's that it evolves. And so, for example, I talked to John Cryan, who I was talking about before, who is a neurobiologist in Ireland. And he was saying, look, you know, people look at me sometimes as if I'm crazy, because neurobiologists are only supposed to look from the neck up. We don't look at other parts of the body to see what's going on. But now that we're starting to see the body a lot more as a system, we're starting to see these things. And so, I think there's no disagreement. I shouldn't say there's no disagreement. There's always disagreement, but there is general consensus that what you eat affects how you feel. The thing that is unknown is the mechanisms. And of course, by mechanism, I mean, how does it happen, right? Like, it's not just in science, you also need to figure out why things happen, not just that they happen. And so there are a lot of scientists who are looking for, you know, like the one great bacteria that's going to cure everything, right? That's going to make you feel well, and it's going to make you lose weight and that kind of thing. And are looking for that. But the body is a system, and the body, it's not about just one bacteria. And so.
And what about the mind? Does it matter whether we cook the food or are eating what someone else has cooked?
Yeah, it does. The flavor is created in the brain. We always think about flavor on the tongue. That's taste. That's one of the senses that creates flavor, but all of our senses create flavor. The touch creates flavor because of the way that the food hits our tongue. In the United Kingdom, they had Cadbury chocolate bars that they turned from circular pieces to square pieces. From square pieces to circular pieces. And everyone got angry because they said that the chocolate tasted sweeter. And it doesn't. They didn't change the recipe. They only changed the shape. And round foods are perceived as sweeter by the brain. The brain perceives those foods as sweeter. For what reason? We don't know. We don't know what the mechanism is. A lot of people love sparkling water. Sparkling water is another branch of touch, in the way that it interacts with your tongue and changes the way that flavor is created. Same with smell, same with hearing. There's a study that people who are eating stale potato chips, you know, predictably didn't eat many of them because they were gross. But then when the researchers piped in sounds of crunching noises, people ate more of the chips and rated them as more delicious. Same chips. So it really matters, everything, what you're hearing, what you're seeing, what you're smelling, what you're touching, what you're tasting. It all matters when it comes to flavor. And of course, the biggest way that you can engage your senses is by starting to cook.
My guest on today's London Lopez at Large is Mary Beth Albright. Her book, Eat and Flourish, How Food Supports Emotional Well-Being. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming live at WBAI.org. You devote a number of pages to the word hanger, which was added to the Oxford English Dictionary in 2018. What does it describe?
So hanger is a combination of the words hunger and anger, and it's sort of rose in a pop culture in the 2010s about, you know, people who feel hungry often have a sensation of feeling anger with that. feeling discomfort, emotional discomfort. And it turns out that anger is a real thing. And the way that it works, one of the ways that it works, it's likely multiple ways, but one of the ways is that there are neurons in our brains called AGRP neurons that are called by the researchers hangry neurons. Like that's what they call them around the labs. And it's because when these neurons are, when you're hungry, these neurons are activated. And those neurons send signals of hunger, which makes sense because, you know, you don't have enough food, but it also sends signals of anger. And evolutionarily, there's no reason that that had to happen, except for they believe the idea that evolutionarily, millennia ago, it wasn't enough for humans to feel a hunger pang to let them know, if you don't have something, just eat soon, you're going to starve to death, right? So nature, our evolution, had anger come along with it because that angry feeling gives us the adrenaline, gives us the cortisol that we can use to go out and find food. Now, in a world where we live in now, where, you know, it feels sometimes like everybody's angry, and whenever you're hungry, you can go to any corner store, go to a bodega and pick something up that, you know, might not be the best for your long-term health. Hunger can be a real problem. And so it's important to know that, because that's just another way that your food and emotions are entwined.
Politics comes into everything. Are hangry neurons a reason some people don't like to be on diets?
I don't know. I would assume and guess, yes, that is part of it. Because there, and that's what I mean by, you know, when I say focusing on weight isn't really helpful when you're talking about emotional well-being, that's what I'm talking about, is that if you're focused only on weight or solely on weight or even specifically on weight, you're probably not going to get enough food at some point. And that is going to mess with your emotional well-being. So not only are you going to have that hanger come into, you know, combat with your mental health, you're also going to be setting yourself up for thinking that you're only good enough if you're a certain weight. And that is absolutely not true.
You describe a study in which students wore sensory deprivation gear and tried to track the scent of chocolate from one point to another. What was the reasoning behind that study?
What were they trying to do? Well, you know, some studies, it's just like people just do. I mean, I there is a reason behind it, but I also think sometimes these researchers are just like, oh, that sounds interesting. Let's try that out. It was to show that human sense of smell was that human sense of smell could track that smell of chocolate and could track that smell of chocolate even better than it could track something that was less caloric than chocolate. And here's why that matters, because we eat what we smell, and our brains have this, our guts have this sense, this gut sense that it sends to our brains when we've had enough nourishment. Our bodies are evolutionarily designed to go after food that is more caloric, that has higher calories, because that's, you know, again, we have all these systems in our bodies that make sure that we get enough food, but very few, if any, to make sure that we stop eating. And so they wanted to show that the human sense of smell was important, was powerful, and important to what people actually wind up eating. And they certainly did. There was another study done by the same group that showed that students who were walking around a city block had greater recall memory for where the high caloric foods were than recall memory for stores that had lower calorie foods. Because it's just
I'm sorry, finish what you're saying, please.
I was just going to say, it's just this thing in our brain. Our brains are obsessed with getting enough food. And so understanding that and being able to work with that is critical.
We don't have a lot of time left, but I wanted to ask you a couple more questions. Don't the ups and downs of our lives often affect what we choose to eat? Does it matter if we're going through a period of stress?
Oh, gosh, yes. The book is about what we as individuals can do in our everyday lives right now. There are so many upstream problems that need to be addressed about to improve the global health, mental health epidemic that we are in right now.
Well, we have a pandemic going on as well.
Absolutely. And that has affected it. And I could go into all kinds of statistics about how much worse mental health is now than it was 3 years ago. But it's a problem. And there's also a loneliness epidemic in this country that the current U.S. Surgeon General has said can reduce lifespan equal to 10 cigarettes a day. Just from being lonely. And that goes back to what I was talking about eating with other people and the importance of that. But we also need to make sure that we remember that it's not just take three walnuts and you'll feel better in the morning, or eat these berries every day and you'll be fine. You know, you'll feel better. Mental health, emotional well-being is, as you said, really complicated. And there are a lot of things going on in everyone's lives that, you know, my father passed away a month ago. And, you know, I wasn't like, oh, I'm just going to eat these blueberries and feel better. You have to go through the process of grieving, which I will be going through for a while. It doesn't get rid of your emotions. It helps you to process those emotions. And I think that's really critical in today's world.
I've been speaking with Mary Beth Albright of the Washington Post about her new book, Eat and Flourish, How Food Supports Emotional Well-Being, published by Countryman Press. I'm sorry we've run out of time. There's so much more to talk about, but it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Oh, Leonard, I've really appreciated it. Thanks for your trust, and thank you to your audience for taking the time to listen.
And that brings us to the end of our show. If you're just discovering this program and would like to hear more of our one-hour deep dive interviews, you can access our nearly 700 past shows streaming on demand at WBAI.org. Our podcast, which has surpassed 1 million plays, is available on iTunes, Apple, and everywhere else you get your podcasts. And if you would like to write to me, my email address is leonardlopate@WBAI.org. Before I sign off today, I need to ask you to support WBAI to keep the show coming to you weekdays from 1 to 2 p.m. We're asking all of our listeners who have the means to do so to make a contribution at whatever level they're comfortable with by calling 212-209-2950 or by going online to give to WBAI.org right now. That's 212-209-2950 or give and then the number to WBAI.org. And as I mentioned earlier, if anyone who makes a contribution of $50 or more in the name of Leonard Lopate at large right now can receive a copy of the book we've been discussing, Eat and Flourish, How Food Supports Emotional Well-Being by Mary Beth Albright. So why not make that call right now, 212-209-2950, or go online to WBAI.org. And you might also consider becoming a sustaining member, what we call a BAI buddy, for $10, $15, $20, $25 a month. If you do, that will help us to plan for the future. But either way, it's important because BAI doesn't take foundation grants. We don't. We rely 100% on listener donations. And we're the only radio station in the New York dial that's 100% listener-sponsored. Your support is tax-deductible. We're off tomorrow, but we hope that you can join us again on Friday when our favorite industrial hygienist, Winona Russell, will be here to discuss the latest health issues and take your calls. We'll see you then.
As New Yorkers, workers, we like things fast. And when it comes to COVID-19, it's all about acting fast. Acting fast to get tested and treatment if you have COVID-19 symptoms. Treatment works best the sooner you start and can help you avoid serious illness. So act fast, especially if you're over 65 or have pre-existing conditions. Call your healthcare provider or 212-COVID-19 for testing and treatment options. And remember, COVID-19 vaccines are still the best protection against serious illness from the virus. Visit nyc.gov/vaccine finder today.
That message brought to you by the New York City Department of Health. This is WBAI New York. Things happen fast on the street. When you're driving, your speed can feel slow. But if you hit someone, it's terrifyingly fast. Drivers, look for pedestrians and cyclists and slow your turns to 5 miles per hour. Speeding ruins lives. Slow down. This message brought to you by the New York City Vision Zero Initiative.
From WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. It is now official. The U.S. will send 31 Abrams battle tanks to Ukraine, Biden administration officials said this afternoon after Germany formally announced that it would send 14 of its Leopard tanks to Ukraine. The U.S. had for weeks urged its European allies to donate Leopards to Ukraine while holding out on sending the Abrams over concerns that complex training and maintenance needs would render it ineffective. According to the AP, the Abrams tanks will be provided through an upcoming security assistance package rather than through existing military stockpiles, meaning it could take months or even years before the tanks reach Ukraine. The Leopard tanks, on the other hand, are likely to be more immediately available and are easier to learn to use. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov called the Western deployment of tanks, quote, extremely dangerous, close quote, and said it would not bode well from the point of view of global and pan-European security. In Florida today, following the state's rejection of a new AP African American Studies course, black elected officials, activists, and the community held a rally inside the Florida Capitol building in protest of the decision. The Stop the Black Attack rally is organized by the Equal Ground Action Fund in partnership with State Senator Chevron Jones. Organizers are opposed to the decision to block the new advanced placement course, which was going to launch pilot programs across the state. The DeSantis administration argued it violated Florida's Stop Woke Act. In related news, teachers in Manatee County, Florida, have taken to covering up or removing books from their class libraries after a new law prohibiting classroom material that hasn't been vetted or approved by so-called certified media specialists went into effect. Teachers found in violation of these guidelines face felony charges. Tyree Nichols, a man who died after a routine traffic stop in Memphis, Tennessee, suffered, quote, extensive bleeding caused by a severe beating, close quote, according to preliminary results of an independent autopsy commissioned by attorneys for the family. Nichols was stopped.